Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Not so happy over at the home of the Happy Meal. We've been talking about it. Shares of McDonald's selling off today. Sales missing investor expectations in the fourth quarter as growth decelerated, hurt in part by the war in the Middle East, something that Bloomberg's Red Brown warned us about on Friday, Tim.
Yeah, shares down about 3.6% right now. Comp sales, a key metric for the restaurant industry, rose 3.4% in the fourth quarter. It's the slowest since the fourth quarter of 2020 and below the average estimate of analysts who were polled by Bloomberg.
All right, this week we're going to hear from more in the restaurant industry. That includes Chipotle, Yum Brands. Chipotle's tomorrow, and I think Yum Brands on Wednesday. And if you look at the sector group, the S&P 500 restaurant sub-industry index, that includes all of these names, it's down nearly 2% year-to-date, gaining nearly 13% in 2023.
Well, we've got a great voice on the whole industry. Michelle Korsmo is CEO of the National Restaurant Association. It's the trade group that represents the industry and includes about a million restaurants and food service outlets here among its members. Michelle here in our Bloomberg studio. Michelle, good to have you with us right now. Good to have you with us this afternoon. What are you hearing from your members about the economy? What are you hearing from them about durability of the consumer and about business?
Thank you, Tim. It's exciting, actually, in the restaurant industry right now. What we're looking at in our State of the Industry report for 2024 is that the sales numbers should be above $1.1 trillion. So a huge economic driver if you look at sales in the restaurant industry, which everybody's very excited about. Of course, the sales numbers don't tell the whole story.
Correct.
Much to what you're talking about.
And when you throw out a number like $1.1 trillion, yeah. Is that above pre-pandemic? Like, give us a number alone, but give us some
right. We are now above pre-pandemic. Last year was the beginning of coming back to pre-pandemic numbers. And so it's great to see that kind of growth in the restaurant industry. But again, it's sales numbers that we're talking about here.
Is that because of higher prices?
Higher prices. And of course, we also see higher expenses.
Well, right? I want to talk about that a little bit, specifically when it comes to wages.
Yes.
Because California, for example, is $16 minimum wage right now.
Right.
A large portion of your members are working in restaurants or have restaurants where minimum wage is par for the course. What is your position when it comes to a national minimum wage and the increase that we're seeing in a lot of different states where there is a higher standard of living?
At the National Restaurant Association, we really love to be engaged in that wage conversation because it's so important to our members, because they're trying to find great workers and a great workforce. And part of how you do that is find that nice balance between trying to ensure profitability in an industry that has tremendously low margins, 3-5% on average, and then also trying to attract great workforce. And so what we found is that the wage question is really one that happens, and the conversation happens at a local level, more at the state level than at the local level than at the federal level. But without a doubt, and anytime you're in a place where you want to talk about what's going on with the minimum wage at the federal level or at the state and local level, we want to be in that conversation.
Is it problematic, though, when it gets to $20 an hour? I'm looking at, that's what, $800 a week?
Right.
That's $3,200 a month. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, if you bring it out to the annual level, most folks would say, wow, that's just somebody maybe getting by,
right.
Barely. And if you have kids or something, it's going to be even more problematic. So I do wonder, you know, restaurants used to be kids in high school and kids, you know, who weren't supporting families, that
right.
kind of thing. It's changed dramatically. So is that part of their thinking about the type of workers that they are essentially hiring? Like, who are they?
Well, it's interesting. We'd love to have more and more of those kids learning how to work in the restaurant industry. But the other thing that's true in the restaurant industry is people tend not to be in those minimum wage jobs very long. What we find is there's a lot of mobility. So if people are in the jobs that are the types that are at the lower wage levels, they usually are in those jobs because they like the convenience of the schedule. There's something else about that particular position that appeals to them. But those that have any kind of longevity in the industry, we'll see those individuals kind of go into other management types of roles where they are bringing in more money. And depending on the restaurant, if you look at a full service restaurant, especially in an environment where there's tipping, you can have very well compensated employees across the restaurant.
What about when it comes to other expenses that we've seen rise over the last couple of years? Mm-hmm. Inputs like dairy, inputs like meat, other food costs that have gone up. What are you hearing from members? Is that stabilized at this point?
It's stabilized. What's interesting about the varying food cost increases is that it's never consistent. So you see dairy prices or egg prices that will go up, meat prices that will go up, and they will often come back down.
Chicken prices have come down a lot, right?
So those things will vary over time depending on what those larger macro pressures are. But what they found then for a restaurant is that it's really important for them to be tremendously agile in the way that they're managing their food costs and the way that they're thinking about the menu that they're putting together for their customers.
So they change the menu.
They change the menu.
To either cut the costs, right? The input costs,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
And so they do that. That's interesting. Well, go back to McDonald's, though, for a moment, because,
sure.
You know, they specifically had warned about some of the concerns in the Middle East. They've been a target,
right.
And some would say rightfully so, but nonetheless, it hasn't had an impact on the bottom line. But growth in some of their other regions weakened as well. We talked a little bit about the U.S. Market overall. Are people, any of your members, you sound very upbeat, are any of them talking recession or slowdown in consumers trading down?
So what we hear about consumers is a desire for value, and we see that.
Is that trading down?
It's not necessarily trading down. What they're interested in is a deal in many cases. So when we do our consumer surveys, what we found is that 7 out of 10 of consumers are looking for some kind of value. And you'll notice that a lot of restaurants now will use apps and loyalty programs where mm-hmm. you get discounts in those apps and among those loyalty programs. And that's part of how restaurants are trying to appeal to consumers to come back to their restaurant time and again. Because we know that even though consumers are concerned about the bottom line and concerned about what's in their pocketbook, they still want to enjoy restaurants. And so the question is, how do we want to make sure that they're coming into your particular restaurant?
So how do restaurants do that? I mean, on one end, you have mm-hmm. Employees who are about to get paid $20 an hour minimum mm-hmm. wage in California in just a few months. On the other side, you want customers who want value, so they want their dollar to go
right.
further. Where does that leave your members?
I think you figured out why the restaurant business is a tough business to manage. What our members are really doing is trying to balance bringing people in for that value and then knowing that there still has to be profitability in that menu. And so you're going to see that change in pricing. But the other thing you're going to see is a change in technology coming to solve a lot of this problem. What we see is more and more restaurant operators using technology to solve both their operational efficiencies.
Like the Autocado.
I was just going to say.
Chipotle. We're kind of obsessed with it.
I think that's part of it. I mean, the other part that I think is when you walk into a fast food restaurant and you don't see people
mm-hmm.
at the cash register, you see a screen that you take your order yourself.
Right. It's a tough balance because everybody wants a smiling face. When you walk into a restaurant, you want to be greeted by a smiling face, and there's no doubt that that's what we want. But we also want an affordable meal. And so there's a balance between having a technology that can provide really consistent, really quick service, and having that hospitality that greets you. And even in the places where you see technology with the kiosks coming in, you usually find that they're delivering your meal to your table. So you're getting a little bit more service, even though that first experience of the order may have been much more of a technological experience.
All right, so if you think about, we started with the overall view, just got 10 seconds here. I mean, a couple of words. Is it glass half full, glass half empty? A couple of words to describe the industry and the outlook 12 months out.
Always glass half full in the restaurant industry. This is an industry made up of entrepreneurs who are forever optimistic. And I think that the big story for us is that growth and driven by a desire for takeout and consumer demand.
All right, well, we'll see what Chipotle and Yum say this week. Michelle, thank you so much. Michelle Korsmo, CEO of the National Restaurant Association. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Also on the radar is what's going on in the Treasury trade today. We talked about bond losses deepening, although off our worst levels, following stronger than estimated economic data on the U.S. services sector today. And then, of course, was the SOT heard around the world, it felt like, Tim.
Yeah, it was Fed Chair Jay Powell on 60 Minutes yesterday. Following last week's FOMC meeting, he seemed very on message about cutting too soon. Check it out.
I think it's not likely that this committee will reach that level of confidence in time for the March meeting, which is in 7 weeks. Almost all of the 19 participants who sit around this table believe that it will be appropriate in their most likely case for us to cut the federal funds rate this year. We just want to see more good data along those lines. It doesn't need to be better than what we've seen or even as good. It just needs to be good. And so we do expect to see that.
That was, of course, Fed Chair Jay Powell on 60 Minutes yesterday. Well, let's get to the interview. With us is Citigroup, a U.S. economist, Veronica Clark, joining us on Zoom here in New York City. Also with us is Bloomberg News international economics and policy correspondent Michael McKee here in the studio. So, Mike, I want to start off with you and just get an update from you about your thoughts on what we heard from Jay Powell last night, if you heard anything different than what we heard from him on Wednesday, and why you think he used a program like 60 Minutes to get the Fed's message out right now.
I don't think we heard anything different. What the market wanted to hear was, when are you going to cut? And he said, not in March.
Which we heard on Wednesday. Right?
I think the markets, it takes a while for them to get whacked upside the head. They do finally seem to be buying what the chairman is selling. I think he went on television to basically communicate with a broader public than Wall Street. He went to tell people that the Fed is still on the job. We still worry about inflation just like you. We're still attentive to bringing down inflation, as we know you want us to do, but this is a really good economy, and maybe you should be a little happy about that.
Not political?
I don't think it was political. If he wanted to be political, he could have attributed
things. But in terms of choosing the format, choosing the timing?
Oh, well, I mean, small p political, not part of this presidential race year, but definitely a period in time when there wasn't anything else competing with it.
All right, that's fair. Hey, Veronica, come on in on the conversation. What was key for you about Jay Powell Part 2? Or like Mike kind of said, is it American public kind of like a teenager you're asking to clean the room and we just got to kind of ask them several times or remind them several times of what the message is?
Yeah, I don't think we heard too much new that we didn't hear on Wednesday. Although it is interesting to note, this interview was probably filmed before we had Friday's employment data. So it will be interesting to see if that changes the Fed calculus at all. But certainly that timing of pushing back on a March rate cut, you know, was timely given the, you know, very strong data we had on Friday, where we're not expecting that March cut.
Mike, does it just to clear up anything? If this was filmed on Thursday before those numbers came out for January, the Fed chair doesn't get those numbers ahead of time, does he?
No, he would not have had them. So you notice they steered away. If you read the transcripts, they steered away from questions about the payrolls.
You must have seen the chatter online ahead of this when it was announced and on Friday, and we got the numbers on Friday, that, you know, people were looking at this as some sort of like bullish signal about jobs.
Well, Wall Street was leaning that way, and there was a lot of research by people who put out previews that suggested we could have a strong report. There were some that were saying there was a chance we'd get a weak report, particularly because of weather. That may have impacted to a certain extent the average hours. Going into Friday, we thought it would be a little stronger than the 185, but nobody thought it would be as strong as it was. So I'm sure Fed officials were taken by surprise. And then you heard Austin Goolsbee today with me, and he sort of puts that in the category of reasons why he's not ready to say March is off the table.
Having said that, we do actually have a clip from your great interview earlier this morning. Let's play it out for everybody, because he does talk about some of the growth, but maybe some of the concerns as well. Let's play it out for everybody.
It feels like the economy's been quite strong on the growth front. You got big jobs numbers, you got big GDP numbers, better than expected. But at the same time, we've had inflation better than expected, too. If we just keep getting more data like what we have gotten, we're well on the I believe that we should be well beyond the path to normalization.
All right. Before we go back to you, Veronica, Mike, so you read that as what? How is he guiding us?
He's guiding us to not take a stand. He's taking both sides of the issue, being a two-handed economist. But I think that he's been somewhat dovish. And I think that if the inflation numbers are going to matter more than the jobs numbers, because if jobs are pushing up inflation, then that'll be evident to the Fed. At this point, it doesn't appear that they are. Most analysts, and you can ask Victoria about this, think that the average hourly earnings was kind of a one-off oddity in this last jobs report. So if we don't see wages going up because the job market is strong, the Fed's going to be very happy with that, and they can still cut rates even if that's the case.
So Veronica, come on in on what Mike said and weigh in on that, if you would.
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely agree. I think the strong labor market data, the strong activity, GDP data, what it's really allowing the Fed to do is, you know, take time, you know, be patient. If we did see that activity data turning, if we saw the labor market weakening, I'm sure the Fed would be cutting much more quickly. But it is allowing them time to watch more inflation data come in. And we might still get, you know, some softer inflation prints, maybe even January, you know, for next week, CPI on Tuesday. That is just more confirmation that they're on the right path. But they're able to be patient right now.
Veronica, it does seem like Citi has a contrarian view, at least when it comes to the consensus right now, because it's that view that the U.S. economy remains in the midst of the greatest macroeconomic volatility in a generation, and that the economy has not yet made a soft landing, and it likely will not make one. Take us into your research here and your thoughts about this.
Yeah, I mean, right now, honestly, the data do look more like the no landing kind of scenario to us. I mean, you know, the average hourly earnings increase on Friday was interesting, and I do agree that it's probably seasonal adjustment or weather or holiday related, and we probably don't see that kind of strength repeat. But we also did get some revisions to 2023. Average hourly earnings was revised up through the whole year. And all the wage measures that we look at, you know, there's the Atlanta Fed wage tracker, employment cost index, they're all kind of running, you know, 4 to 5%. And that is not consistent with 2% underlying inflation. That's still more like 3%. So I do think you need a further loosening, weakening in the labor market to really get that last wage element to where you want it to be.
So wait.
We might still see that.
So if no landing, does that mean no recession? Or are you just saying that this cycle is longer than maybe we were expecting?
Yeah, no, I mean, we can see it either way. So we're actually still expecting that we will get a recession at some point. Obviously, jobs data on Friday were very strong. But if we go back to the end of last year and really what we're seeing in a lot of the labor market data, we have seen signs of underlying weakening. We have definitely seen hiring rates slow down and people remaining on unemployment benefits for longer. If that is still the case as we're getting into the spring when hiring should normally be picking up, you would expect to see much weaker employment data at that point. And it really is the labor market that's the last key, you know, remaining support for the economy. We've had very strong GDP growth, but that's mostly all in consumption.
Well, so Mike, and I know this is something we've talked about before, especially on the labor market side of things for a moment, is it just, again, we have another day where we have some headlines about job cuts and a story about tech job cuts in particular. So is it just a case that that data will ultimately catch up in, I don't know, February, March data maybe, or April data? Or I'm trying to, again, kind of make sense against those headlines versus the headline jobs report on Friday.
Right, and I'm thinking, Mike, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the job gains that we're seeing month after month aren't necessarily in the categories that where we see the job losses. Is that right?
Well, to a certain extent, that's true, but I think we don't know is the answer to your question,
no, that's
Carol.
That's not acceptable.
because we don't know what is going on in other industries and with hiring. Here's the thing, the number we got Friday is a net number. There are hundreds of thousands of jobs lost, people laid off every mm-hmm. month, and hundreds of thousands hired, and there were, in this case, more than 300,000 extra people hired. So the fact that we're getting layoff announcements, we focus on the layoff announcements, but companies don't put out a lot of press releases about we're hiring, right, you know, two, three people at a time or whatever. So you only get that one side of the story. And Snap today, 10% of their workforce, that's been the repeated theme, 10% of their workforce. Well, they have 5,365 employees or something like that. So worldwide, we're talking about 530 jobs. So it's not going to move the needle a whole lot. You need a lot of layoffs, and that's what we don't know whether that's going to be coming or not. We haven't seen it yet.
Are you starting to see that in your research, Veronica? A lot of layoffs, something beyond what we're seeing just in the tech industry, the 32,000 that have been tracked by layoffs.fyi so far this year?
Yeah, not yet. I mean, we're certainly, you know, watching the headlines, the anecdotes also. But yeah, we really haven't seen the signs of the widespread layoffs yet. You know, we have a layoff rate that comes with the monthly JOLTS data, which we also had last week. It's still very low. Would certainly be watching, you know, the initial jobless claims data that we get every week. You know, that's going to be a really important leading sign for what payrolls are going to do. You know, that was very low in January. That kind of was the signal for why January was going to be so strong. So we haven't quite seen that yet. But I think, you know, we have seen the evidence that people have pulled back on hiring. Hiring rates in that JOLTS report, they're back to 2014, 2016 kind of levels. Even the ISM services report that we had today, it was only, you know, three industries, a very low percentage of industries that actually said they were, you know, increasing employment levels. So there are those signs that hiring has slowed down.
So is it just a case, Veronica, like this period that we're in, we're getting lots of Fed speakers, we are going to just kind of go day-to-day from economic point to economic point, data-dependent, anybody? And then also with the Fed speakers, is that just kind of what kind of guides you and your team's research at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's obviously the market is looking to also. And I don't think, you know, right now it does seem like there is still that consensus of a nice soft landing. But I don't really know if anyone has high conviction in that. You know, it's consensus, but not a high conviction consensus, maybe. We're getting into...
Well, Mike, because you asked Jay Powell. I thought that was just really smart at the press conference. You're like, well, if not a soft landing, then what, right?
Yeah. They don't want to go on record because they don't want to have to backtrack. They don't want to say we got a soft landing and then something goes wrong. We're the ones who are going to declare it a soft landing. But I think that the idea that you're going to be able to identify a time when the soft landing occurred is not very easy to do, because it is a kind of constant. The economy doesn't land. So we could look back and say we had a soft landing in February, but maybe by November it's not.
When would you be comfortable, or what would you need to see to be comfortable to say that we have indeed landed and it's been soft?
Well, I'm not an arbiter, but I would say...
But you've been doing this for a
while. I would say
the
only thing you probably need to add to what we have now is inflation going down a little more, closer to the Fed's target, so they can consider cutting rates. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be a 50-50 choice at a meeting. And at the same time, unemployment hasn't gone way up. If unemployment stays around 4 or less and inflation comes down to 2.4% or 2.5%, depending on your measure, then you could probably say it's a soft landing. But then again, then the question becomes, how long did it last?
Mm-hmm. Right, in terms of the timing. Veronica, just saving you 10 seconds, our final thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, on the soft landing, I mean, I think, you know, there is obviously the growth element to it, the inflation element to it. And I don't honestly think it is just inflation data alone that's going to tell us if we're there or not. You know, we've had 6 months of core PC inflation that is 2% or below, you know, right around the Fed target. But I do not have confidence that it would stay there when wages are still rising 4-5%, home prices 10% annualized. All those signs are not great.
All right, get ready to go day to day, everybody. Citigroup U.S. economist Veronica Clark, and of course, Bloomberg News international economics and policy correspondent, his interview with Austin Goolsbee. Mike's, it's on the Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
This may feel a little bit like Indiana Jones on a mission, one that could result in the world all of a sudden having access to ancient writings that could completely rewrite the history of key periods of the ancient world. I mean, that would be super cool, Tim, to say the least.
Yeah, and to be fair, folks have tried for years to do this. It's not easy, though, to handle a vast library of ancient scrolls that are some 2,000 years old and were buried by the same volcanic eruption back in 79 AD that froze Pompeii in time.
All right, unless, we had some really cool next-level technology that could help make them readable. Oh, wait, we do have it. It's called AI. So let's get to it. This story is this week's Bloomberg Business Week cover story. New issue out on newsstands on Wednesday, already online and on the Bloomberg terminal. Writing about it, Bloomberg Business Week features writer Ashley Vance and Bloomberg News tech features writer Ellen Hewitt. Ashley, as you know, author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future, and When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. He joins us from Palo Alto, California. Ellen is in our San Francisco bureau. Hey, Ashley, we want to start with you. First of all, you're on the phone because the weather's in California, a lot of rains. How are you doing? Everything okay?
Everything's fine. I just have no internet.
I get it.
Ironic, yeah. As we talk about this very high-tech story.
It is kind of ironic, right? Weather puts us in our place often. Ashley and Ellen, great story. First of all, Ashley, kick it off for us. How did this kind of pop up on your guys' radar?
Yeah, well, there's this there's a guy named Nat Friedman who I've known for a while. He used to be the CEO of GitHub, which Microsoft acquired a few years ago. And he seems to get interested in strange things. And he had heard that, like you guys mentioned, you know, years ago, we knew that there were all these ancient Roman and Greek scrolls that were buried by Vesuvius, and we hadn't been able to read them. We knew the scrolls were there. They were just charred to a crisp, and so nobody could unroll them and read them. And he heard about this, got obsessed with the Roman Empire, and thought, well, maybe, you know, somehow AI technology could read these scrolls. And so last year he created a contest around this called the Vesuvius Challenge. And that's the heart of our story, is following this contest over the last year and the astonishing results.
Yeah, so Ellen, talk to us a little bit about some of those results. Has AI actually been able to solve this puzzle that for hundreds of years, people have worked on trying to unscroll these scrolls?
Yeah, and it's been absolutely amazing because if you compare what we can see now to what people for hundreds of years have tried to get out of these scrolls, you know, doing things to the scrolls that I think, as Ashley wrote in our story, would make historians weep, you know, in the 1700s. They tried to, like, unroll them an inch at a time. They cut them apart. They, like, tried to, you know, piece together these, like, tiny fragments of scrolls. What we have instead is, you know, technology that uses these very powerful scanners to scan the entire scroll untouched, and then to use, you know, to sort of virtually unscroll them. And you end up with these big segments of images that are, you know, impossible to read to the human eye, but which these very pioneering and hardworking volunteers have, you know, been competing to try to build the right AI models that can actually do ink detection and show the words that are on there. And yeah, the announcement today is that there's a team that has won the grand prize of $700,000 for meeting the requirements of the contest, which was to have, you know, a certain chunk of the script readable, as deemed by this team of classicists and papyrologists who have been looking at the results that the different teams have turned in.
It is so cool. And it's so interesting, you guys, because we are trying to figure out, you know, AI, we talk about it a lot and what it could maybe do or not do. We're all trying to figure it out. And here's kind of real life proof of what it could do in terms of unlocking some of the world's history. Ashley, come on back in. We've been showing those watching on TV and YouTube and on Bloomberg streaming, you know, pictures of the scrolls, and they, to be quite honest, they do look like logs.
And they don't look like scrolls, okay?
And I could see how someone, as people did in the past, right, just toss them out.
Yeah, like this is like a burnt hot dog or something. Like, you know, these things do not look like they're ever going to be readable.
No, but how much information? Tell us a little bit more about what we know about them so far.
Yeah, well, look, it could be astonishing. So the villa where these were found, it belonged to Julius Caesar's father-in-law, and he was very wealthy, and he had this huge villa, and we've only excavated a tiny part of it. Basically, there's 800 scrolls that we found that come from a closet, and the thinking is that someone like this would have tens of thousands of more scrolls, and nobody's wanted to excavate them because we couldn't read them, and they always broke whenever we handled them. But just to be clear to everyone, you know, this, if there are more scrolls and we can continue to read them like this, we will almost certainly get new works by Aristotle, Sophocles, Aeschylus, Sappho. This would multiply, you know, our collection of knowledge many times. What we found so far is text relating to this Epicurean named Philodemus, and what the contestants discovered was a writing about pleasure and how the Stoics might be wrong and kind of boring, and we should take joy in food and smell and senses in life.
Hey, Ellen, take us into the technology here and how exactly the team was able to actually do this and use AI, use X-ray technology to get to what is written on these.
Right, so the underlying technology is similar to what you might find in medical imaging, like CT scans, and they take these ultra-powerful scans of the scrolls, and then there's all this work that has to happen before you can even start to try to apply these models to it. Basically, they have to flatten and segment the scrolls, so they take these images and do this work digitally to try to get pages, segments of pages, where then the contestants can start trying to use different models that they designed to try to figure out ink detection. The team that ended up winning the grand prize found this particular strategy that actually came from a different contestant's unique insight, which was, you know, instead of just looking at, you know, instead of trying to build a model, he actually just spent time staring at the images of the papyrus and noticed at some point that there were these patterns, these very faint patterns that he called crackle, which are kind of look like dried up mud. And the idea is that maybe this is like some sort of indication of ink. Anyway, this crackle insight led to some of the other contestants using those crackle letters to start a model, which they then used to reveal other letters, which they fed back into the model, which revealed more letters, and built this very kind of, you know, bespoke model specifically for this need, and ended up, yeah, being able to reveal vast swaths of letters. It's pretty incredible.
So, Ashley, we know there are lots of scrolls that are yet to be unearthed at this point, or that's what we think. But what about this technology and this technique being used for other applications? How are analysts thinking about that?
Well, I think, you know, definitely this kind of technology seems like it could be useful for a lot of ancient texts that we've thought were, you know, just untouchable in the past. It is, to Ellen's point, very specific in this area. But I think the kind of cool thing is throughout this contest, we've seen these kind of 20-something-year-old computer scientists, you know, teaming with these papyrologists and classicists who tend to be a bit older. And there's just this like renewed excitement that wow, okay, this kind of technology could be applied to our field. And maybe a lot of things that we thought just were impossible are now possible. And so, I mean, I think Ellen would agree. There was so much enthusiasm around this from these generations coming together in these two disparate fields colliding.
That's what I loved. Ellen, jump in on this, because I thought as I read this story, it's like folks watching YouTube videos to learn different things. And this idea of, you know, there's a lot of criticism about everything that's out there in the world of social media, and probably understandably so and fairly so. But this story shows when different generations, different people in different fields, different people around the world start tapping and working together, what can be the outcome?
Yeah, I think it's just incredible. It's the story of, you know, several different people just catching this bug where they became totally obsessed with the, you know, the huge ramifications of maybe being able to read these scrolls and coming up with these innovative ideas of being like, okay, we have this advanced technology. Maybe we can do something that we really, really could not do before. So Luke Ferreter, for example, was one of the three people in the winning team, talks to us about how, yeah, he was an intern at SpaceX, happened to listen to a podcast in which Nat Friedman was describing the contest. And he just had this thought, like, maybe I'm the one who could do this. And he's so enthusiastic about it. And he spent all this time and energy trying to work on it, you know, like sending images off to his model in the middle of he was at like a college party and like, you know, sent the images off to this model and then checked back a few hours later and saw these letters that had been revealed. And, it, you know, I think his enthusiasm, like for something that is just right. Not, you know, what you would expect to apply AI to, I think that has just been really inspiring.
All right, lots more to go. 10 seconds for you, Ashley, because it's just about 5% of one scroll they figured out. There's a lot more work to be done, correct? And just quickly.
There is, and there's a new contest coming. So the goal is to get from 5% to 95% of the scroll, and then Nat's pretty determined to excavate the rest of the site if he can.
All right, all you nerds out there, you can apply. Awesome. No, I love nerds. I am one. Ashley Vance, Bloomberg Business Week features writer and Bloomberg News Tech features writer, Ellen Hewitt. Check it out in the new issue.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Carol, I don't know if you saw, but late last month, we got earnings from one of the dominant companies when it comes to the cloud space. And the company's shares hit a record high. We're talking about SAP. After the company raised its 2025 free cash flow guidance and announced a restructuring program that will affect 8,000 jobs, we also learned the company's current cloud backlog. And that's why I bring this up. Current cloud backlog, which is an indicator of cloud revenue to be booked within the next 12 months, saw accelerating growth in the fourth quarter, signaling robust demand for its cloud-based software.
All right. We knew we wanted to know more. So we've got back with us, Julia White. She's Chief Marketing and Solutions Officer at SAP. And a member of the executive board joining us on Zoom from Seattle, last on with us in July. So talk to us a little bit about the overall broad environment, because it does sound like coming off your earnings, optimism from the company overall. We just want to kind of start there in terms of what you are seeing, because we've talked a lot about the cloud over the last week or two with a lot of big names, whether it's Alphabet, whether it's Amazon, whether it's Google, like a lot of them reporting. So tell us, you know, more in terms of what you guys are seeing from demand.
Absolutely. I mean, it was a strong year and a quarter for us as well, as to your note. And it really is that part time where customers are shifting fully to a cloud first strategy. I think that's been true in some parts of their technology, but now really into the business application, right? The place where SAP particularly works and the importance of moving to a cloud first. And of course, we couldn't not talk about how AI is a key part of that as well and helping drive that and enable that too.
I also want to talk about big picture here. Carol, when I was preparing this, Carol put some notes in here about like looking at the competitors here. So like Microsoft Cloud, Google Cloud, Amazon AWS. Mm-hmm. I went to our own Bloomberg Intelligence just by pressing BI Go on the Bloomberg terminal. And here, there's a theme that I see when it comes to our analysts writing about the cloud. Our analysts on Microsoft Cloud, they write a rebound in cloud and more AI workloads to gain high teen sales annually in the next 3 years. On Google Cloud, they write about YouTube and cloud partially offsetting slowdown in search because cloud is benefiting from AI tools and a rebound in IT spending. And then Bloomberg Intelligence on Amazon AWS, enterprise spending ramping back up. So the theme really that I'm seeing here, Julia, is a rebound when it comes to the cloud. Talk to us what you're seeing at SAP outside of what you're doing at SAP that shows there is a rebound happening when it comes to this IT spend.
Absolutely. And like I said, you know, all those players you mentioned are cloud infrastructure players that had boomed during COVID, right? It leveled off and now AI is driving a new wave. And not, you know, we're in an application layer, so similar, but a few different trends. We've seen customers like picking up their existing SAP system and running them on a cloud, but that's not transforming their business, right? They're just doing the same thing on a cloud service. Now they're the cloud first approach. And again, back to AI, if customers want to really change their business model, right? Like Tech Mahindra was selling cars in lots. Now they're selling them online at much different scale. You need different technologies. You need different application experiences to enable that. And we've been very clear that really the only way for customers to get the latest and greatest AI is to use the cloud-based applications. And so again, that's helping, you know, people who were thinking about it, maybe going to do it later. Now they're like, now it's time, right? It's time to do it now. Because if my competition gets this new AI capability and I don't, guess what? I'm going to fall behind.
Is there certain application software that people in particular are tapping into in this environment that says something about their focus specifically?
I think, you know, when you change your business model, right, going from, say, like maybe products to a service business, and you have to think about all the parts of your business processes that change, how you account for things, how you reap subscriptions, right? How do you provide service end to end? All of those parts of the business have changed, which means all the business applications they use have to also change. And so obviously the things SAP does, right? The finance and accounting and asset management, supply chain, human resource management, all those pieces are affected as well.
We love talking to people like you because you have a good insight into what your customers are saying about how much they're willing to spend, what portion of their revenues are going to this type of spending. How would you characterize it in 2024 and how that's changed in recent years? We certainly saw a ramp up in 2020, 2021, but what are you seeing right now?
Yeah, I think the IT spend kind of leveled off in 2023, as you see. As we go into 24, we see more increase in spend generally. If you look at all the CIO surveys or the IT surveys in general, last year people kind of cut programs to experiment with AI. We saw that. This year they baked that in and they're planning to invest particularly around AI-enabled experiences.
My understanding coming in here that you kind of had three main macro trends for 2024. Mm-hmm. We've hit on some of it: generative AI, competitive pressure, a second thing that is a real big trend this year, and the third being economic uncertainty, putting businesses under pressure, driving them to adopt efficiency at their core. Go down that avenue or that rabbit hole with me, if you would, because I'm trying to get an idea of how much uncertainty, like give me an idea of that economic environment. Is it akin to, I don't know, another moment of uncertainty in our recent history?
Well, what we see with the uncertainty is, particularly in the area we serve, people are still making choices. It's just taking longer, right? They're really having to show the return on it. They're having to prove it. And also we're seeing that they're being more collaborative in the groups within the company to make a decision to invest in something. So it's just changing the decision-making processes when there's uncertainty, right, in terms of the criteria. And to your question of a recent time of I could think of, is maybe when the cloud started to level off like around COVID, where people weren't quite sure what to do.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it's quite as dramatic as that. And I also think the economic indicators are starting to look better. Mm. And so people are starting to go. But again, the criteria for making a big investment in the technology decision, I think the bars have been raised.
How much opportunity is there for new business? Not just increasing business from existing customers, but who is left who hasn't made the transition to the cloud?
Well, again, people might be using some cloud in their organization, but not necessarily for the core of running their business, right? So we still, about half of our kind of, we have our hero offering, Rise with SAP core kind of ERP system. Half of that's coming from new customers, not existing customers.
Is there a certain type of business, though, that like a certain size business, type of business that has been, I mean, in my view, and I don't work in IT infrastructure by any means, but this tech has been around for a while. Like, why have these companies waited until now?
Yeah, we definitely see more in the like the mid-market kind of growing companies are coming up, or newer companies, frankly. A lot of companies try and go as far as they can using things like Excel to run their finances, right? And it just breaks at some point, and then they need to flip over and use a true kind of business application.
Interesting too, and I know sometimes it's hard to share, you know, information about some of your customers or clients, but I know one that you, I think, are willing to is what's going on with Mahindra. Talk to us about them. It's a well-known company, massive multinational organization based out there, based in India. So what is it specifically that you guys have done with them to give us kind of an idea of maybe the types of projects that you're working on with some of your customers?
Yeah, that's a good example of not just doing the same thing somewhere else, but doing it fundamentally differently, right? When they first launched their very first SUV in India, now again, they sold it just in lots, you know, the traditional way. And their rate back then was, you know, selling one car every 30 minutes, right? That kind of a rate when they first launched, right? Then they shifted and said, no, let's go digital. Let's go e-commerce. Let's go online. Let's scale with cloud capability. We can go global that way as well. So then they just recently launched their new SUV. They sold 100,000 cars in the first 30 minutes as just a contrast. And it's certainly the scale and the global reach, but it's also about just embracing a new business model. And that's, to me, a wonderful example of doing both quite well.
Wow. So, I mean, it's Carol, it's interesting that, again, I go back to the idea that there are so many companies out there who haven't yet leveraged the idea of, you know, doing this stuff in the cloud. It just makes me think like, okay, well, even though we're talking about it every day and all the companies that we cover have been in it. I mean, look at AWS has been doing this for years.
Right.
There's still companies out there who are not doing this.
Right. And as Julia points out, you know, kind of the distinction, right? And this is when we talk to about whether it's AI, like who benefits, maybe it doesn't matter. You know, right now people are kind of banking on the infrastructure part of it. And you think about AWS or Alphabet, that is a lot, you know, larger the infrastructure, but then you need programs that work on top of it. And that's where a company like SAP comes in. Hey, Julia, always good to check in with you. So really appreciate it. Be well. Julia White, she's Chief Marketing and Solutions Officer over at SAP, joining us on Zoom from Seattle.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive. You drive
me crazy. It's the question that drives us. You drive me
crazy. This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, folks, just got about 18 minutes left in today's trading session. Heard Charlie breaking down the numbers here, bouncing around here, down across the board on the equity side of things, but we're definitely off our worst levels of the session. And it really has been largely about what's going on in the Treasury trade following Jay Powell on 60 Minutes. Again, some strong U.S. economic data, specifically on the services sector, so important to the U.S. economy. And so you see yields pretty much hovering at their best levels of the session. I feel like we're being a little bit managed, but we're also being reminded by Fed officials, Jay Powell included last night, data dependent, folks. So we're going to watch
data dependent.
Strong.
Have I heard that before?
Yes.
Did you come
times.
Up with that, Carol? Did you come up
data
with
dependent,
that?
Data dependent. By the T-shirt and the hat.
Somebody get Jay Powell a tattoo that says data dependent. Hey, I'm really curious what Dana DiOria has to say about all this. Dana's co-chief investment officer of InvestNet. They got about $375 billion in assets under management. Dana joins us from Pennsylvania this afternoon. Good to have you with us. How are you looking at what we heard from Fed Chair Jay Powell last night versus what we heard from him last Wednesday? Did you see any difference between those two messages?
I think it's just a doubling down. And, you know, it was odd. The market, you know, had kind of, I thought, to a certain extent, priced in that there would be no March rate cut. But they don't like hearing them keep focusing on that, too. These comments came after more fantastic, you know, data on unemployment, where, you know, I think the market is kind of accepting the fact that, in fact, it might take a while, maybe not even after March, right, that we're going to see these rate cuts. So we're still seeing rate cuts priced in, of course. But I think the market is, you know, coming to grips that it's certainly not going to be March. And it might not even, you know, be soon thereafter.
You know, it's interesting, though. I always think about after a Fed meeting, Dana, about that big table and the Federal Reserve and the kind of conversations that they have and the kind of debates. And I think about someone like you guys as well. You've got $375 billion in assets under management. It's a lot of money. Your clients and investors turn to you all. You and your team, what are the kind of discussions and really kind of smart debates that you are having right now about kind of what happens next over the next 6 to 12 months?
So we are platform, and you know that number that you're putting out that we're referencing is our TAMP. So there's many asset managers under there. So we are able to see, you know, what different asset managers have to say about, to your point, what's going on in the market, as well as research. You know, a lot of different pundits, you kind of sit at a nice aggregation point for that. And you know, it's been a lot of, I mean, if I were to give you kind of a aggregated bubble up of what you get out of that.
Dana, hang on a second. We're going to just try and fix your audio because it's a little bit muffled, and we just want to make sure that everybody can hear. So I'm going to let my team work with you for a second and just try and fix that up. In the meantime, we just want to do a quick check on the markets because we have talked about traders sending bonds sliding once again, stronger than estimated economic data. That was something that Dana just talked about, and signals that the Fed isn't ready to call victory over inflation just yet have really once again gotten a sell-off in the Treasury trade, and you've got a 10-year right now with a yield of about 4.16, and you've got the shorter end most susceptible to what the Fed is going to do or not do at 4.47, below 4.5%, but just below it.
And on the equity market side, we're seeing the S&P 500 down just about 0.2%, we can round it up to 0.3%. It's actually surprising to me, Carol. We saw at one point today, down more than 0.8%, and mm-hmm. the Dow was down significantly more than it is now. Dow down 0.6%, the Nasdaq down 0.2%.
This is the tricky part, right, of being an investor. Good when you see upbeat economic data, the economy not falling apart. We got that, you know, thinking.
But it's not Fed friendly.
But it's not necessarily Fed friendly, or it just means, listen, Jay Powell clearly on Wednesday said this peak, the peak in the cycle in terms of the raising rates, we're done. We're good. It's just a case of when and by how much the Fed starts to cut rates, right? That's the next move we are expecting to see. And so this is where if you run a company, you've got to figure out, okay, does the Fed get it right? Or do we ultimately see some kind of more significant slowdown in economic activity and business activity? All right, Dana DiOria is back with us, Co-Chief Investment Officer of InvestNet. that, you know, when all else fails, we just put you on the phone. It works. It works. All right. So we were asking you about kind of the smart discussions you're having with your team about maybe some of the stress points or what are the most important narratives to debate at this point? What are they?
Yeah, and it's a good question for us because we're a platform. We have many asset managers that are contributing to that, you know, $400 billion, $379 billion. So, you know, very much we get to see a lot of different data points. And I would say if what bubbles up out of that is a lot of folks who've kind of come around to this soft landing scenario just because the market almost doesn't allow for anything else, right? We just continue to go strong. But there is an undercurrent with some of the managers kind of saying, hey, look, guys, you know, it's been about 2 years since the tightening cycle started, and now's around the time when we would expect some cracks. So I think, you know, to a certain extent, everybody is certainly plowing into the market and obviously enjoying the great returns there. But there's definitely an undercurrent coming from, you know, certain parts of the management and, you know, research services around, hey, there are reasons to kind of be a little cautious.
What might those cracks be?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously we saw unemployment come in very nicely, and, you know, that's the one that you've got to look out for, because it's obviously the mandate for the Fed is inflation and unemployment. I think the cracks would be there, right? And so you're not seeing it now. I mean, there were hours were down in January, which is interesting, but really kind of just suggests you should, let's see what the next month brings. But, you know, inflation tending to come in waves, the fact that, you know, you still have wage growth issues that could drive higher inflation. The Fed very much firm on the decision not to cut rates anytime soon. And so, you know, those are some of the pieces of that that I think are, you know, the market. And then, you know, things like the deficit, the fact that it's going to be a potentially volatile year on the political front, not just in the U.S., but globally.
Dana, are you getting concerned at all by tech layoffs that we're seeing? 32,000, according to layoffs.fyi. In the just so far this year. Does that concern you at all?
Yeah, I think that, you know, big tech has been kind of priced for perfection. And the AI boom that everyone is excited about, while, you know, potentially game changing, you know, hard to see that really filters into corporate returns in the near term, right? And so it's the kind of thing where everyone getting excited about it, driving up multiples in these companies. But in the immediate term, you know, you don't hear a lot about specifics around how it's going to get into productivity increases, et cetera. Mm. Some are there. There's definitely, you know, but we know these tech stocks have been priced to perfection. I'm very much in the camp of, you know, tilting the portfolio a little bit away from there, tilting more, you know, to fundamentals-based price, smaller size, et cetera.
But you're not seeing, just real quickly, 25 seconds, as you said, you've got a lot of investors on your platform. You get to see a lot. You don't see a lot of investors running for the exits when it comes to the mega cap tech, just quickly.
Nope, I don't. And I also think most people are, if anything, they would let it ride as opposed to rebalancing back, which, you know, to our... You should make sure the ballast is in your portfolio.
All right, good stuff. Thanks. And thanks for jumping on the phone so we could continue the conversation. Dana DiOria, she's co-chief investment officer at InvestNet, $375 billion in assets from all of the investors that use their platform on Zoom from Pennsylvania. On the phone, actually, from Pennsylvania.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more. So you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.